Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Chris Cameron, my co-host, Felicity Sidnell Reed, and our guest this week, poet and editor, Susan Gillis. Susan, I understand you've recently moved to rural Ontario. So tell me, have your writing practices and routines changed since you moved? For instance, you need peace and solitude in order to write, or have you found it there?
Well, too much solitude can make for, well, I guess we're all sort of discovering what too much solitude can do these days, but no, it hasn't really changed. I've always been quite disciplined about creating the space I need in terms of a focused stillness and the kind of peaceful environment around me that allows for deep attention. Time is what has been short in the past, and now I have lots of that. So that has changed.
That's a wonderful gift, isn't it, to have the time? I was going to ask you whether the topics of your writing were changed, but I suppose some of them are, since you don't probably write about bears and things in downtown Montreal. Is there a change to the way that you approach your writing because you have more time and more space now, or has it always been the same?
That's a good question. I don't think it has changed a lot. It's been important to me throughout my writing life to maintain a practice of morning notebook time. And so now that just lasts longer instead of, you know, being given over to getting ready for work. My subjects haven't changed in the sense that I've always been interested in threshold moments like that one with the bear. Sort of in between states of being, people in relation to each other and the world that we inhabit, change itself and what it does and how we deal with it. And I guess if anything has changed, it would be in my image sets, like you notice. It's the bear in the quarry instead of the truck and the pothole in the street.
So the themes might be universal, but the message is the same.
Yeah.
What do you think then? I mean, does place affect how we write and what we say?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of writers do locate themselves and their work very specifically in place. I don't think that has been so true for me. It may be now, having left several places, I look back to place a little bit more than I might have at another point in my writing life.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. I mean, yeah, you look at someone like Wordsworth, who obviously wrote while he was mm-hmm. in a place, and
yes.
yet his messages are not necessarily confined to that one place. They are mm-hmm. universal. At any rate,
yeah.
I can switch gears a bit. Can we talk about your latest book, Yellow Crane?
Yeah.
So why yes. the title Yellow Crane?
Oh, well, when I still lived in Montreal, as I mentioned, I began every morning with my notebook at the window. And one day there appeared on the horizon, which isn't very far away in the city, a crane. Obviously, you know, rooftops and tree crowns over, it was doing something. And I looked at that crane every day for, oh, I don't know, it seemed like a year. It must have been a year, and found that it was working its way into what I was writing. It would turn up in poems when I didn't really expect it. It was just so physically present in my environment. And I began to realize gradually that what I was writing about was what was going on over there, in a sense, the changes that were happening, not just to landscape or view, but actual physical topography. And I was thinking about what it means to be alive in a particular now, a particular here, and how we all experience the same now and the same here in vastly different ways sometimes surprising ways. So that realization of what I was writing dawned on me gradually.
So is that what's driving the sequence of poems, the point of view, change of point of view in life?
I think so. And the strange thing that happened was I didn't notice the crane was gone until I saw a flatbed truck go by under the window with these pieces of giant yellow Meccano set on them. I don't even know if that was the same crane, but I looked up to the sky and there it wasn't, which was sort of when I realized that that's what the book was about. There it isn't.
There it is and there it isn't. And you might not even notice it's going, but you
exactly.
notice eventually when it's gone.
a part of the work of a poet, I think, is to notice that going, that absence.
I love that. That's a beautiful way of putting it. That's great. It's funny. When somebody looks at the title Yellow Crane, if you're living in Africa, you might think of a different thing with the name Yellow Crane than if you're living in downtown Montreal.
That was deliberate. It's nod to my interest in multiple forms and collaborations.
You said that Yellow Crane tracks the changing landscapes and the places you inhabit most often. And I think you may have addressed that by saying that it was there and then it wasn't there. There's a changing landscape. By landscape, you mean the actual place, or do you mean an interior state of being as well?
Well, that is definitely part of it. It's a book of watching and listening and reading as much as anything, and reading and wondering and reconsidering texts as well as landscapes. So along with that, I guess I would say it's about reconsidering assumptions and things that I think I know or remember, or things I discover that I don't really know in the way that I thought I had. So I think of it, as all poetry, as a kind of conversation with place and time, certainly other works of literature, art, and the self and other people than other poets. It's a book that's partly argument, partly revision. There's certainly fear and joy in being alive.
Thank you. I was going to say, because we have a minute or two, maybe I could backtrack to a question that Felicity asked you earlier and ask you to elaborate a little longer about poetry. Why do we study it? Why should we study it? And how would you deal with skepticism in poetry, if you can?
Yeah, okay, thank you. Thank you for that question. I taught English literature, particularly poetry, in a cégep in Quebec for a long time. And in that situation, the classroom was probably 85% filled with students who were there because it fit their schedule. And most of them were really afraid of poetry and how they were going to do, because, you know, how a lot of people feel about poetry when they don't really know what it is. So I think that one of the things that makes poetry important is it's a form of wealth that can't really be monetized. I mean, people try, but, you know, we carry it around with us that nobody can take it away from us. The impact of an image that's we've had a visceral response to, some, you know, fragment of verse that we carry around because it just feels, you know, good in our ears and in our hearts and bodies. And if we can bring ourselves to open again with wonder to something that we don't understand, the way we used to when we were children, the way I did when I started hearing about the Toronto Raptors and realizing, well, basketball, what's basketball? I don't know, boring. But then you watch and you begin to understand what is really going on there, and develop an appreciation for it, and then it becomes beautiful. So that's what I say to skepticism about poetry. Well, just try it, you know? Aren't we all skeptical about some things? But
There's a fellow named Adam Sowell who has written a wonderful book called How a Poem Moves.
Yes.
And in that, he addresses that whole issue of people who are afraid of poetry or who think it's something that's not really. And he does a marvelous job over a period of about 30 poems and sort of unpacking all of that.
Yeah, he does that. He does that so well in that book. I recognize there's a teacher whose classroom you'd want to be in. But I think it's so important to understand and accept that it's really natural to reject or dismiss or be a little bit bored by the things that we don't get. That's entirely fair reaction.
Susan, could I ask you to read from Yellow Crane?
Yes, of course. Morning Light. Without mention of blossoms, Milos gets the tree in the poem from translucent to laden with fruit. Years passed, not days, while he slept, and that tree must have flowered many times. In the same way, we turn over mid-dream or after love, those beautiful hours we know were passed in the company of genius, but have forgotten in the particulars. We know the tree stands for promise and for the desire, which comes much later, for atonement. We stand at the west-facing window and let the buildings opposite turn gold, then back to brick.
Thank you, Susan. That was beautiful. And thank you for coming in and talking about your poetry today and your life as a poet and your poems. Is there somewhere that listeners can purchase your book, Yellow Crane, or anything else that you've written?
Yes, the place to order books these days, I think, is probably from your local bookstore that will deliver to your door, or directly from the publisher brickbooks.ca/books/yellow-crane.
Well, thanks again, Susan. Thanks for coming in. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, and for your dedication to poetry and radio.
To connect with us, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for who we might interview in future programs to our website, wordonthehills.com, where all our broadcasts are archived. We love to hear from you, and we welcome your comments on our programs. Thanks for tuning into the show. We hope you'll join us for another program next week on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio.